WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
In a few seconds, you will hear one of the most intriguing, husky voices of the stage or screen. My guest is actress Colleen Dewhurst. Some of her films include Annie Hall, The Dead Zone, and The Nun Story. This year, she won an Emmy Award for her performance in the made-for-TV movie Between Two Women, which co-starred Farrah Fawcett as her daughter-in-law. For years, Dewhurst acted primarily in the theater. She's considered one of the preeminent interpreters of playwright Eugene O'Neill. Recently, she has been touring in a one-person show about O'Neill called My Jean. She plays O'Neill's widow, Carlotta Monterey, who is institutionalized in the mental ward of a New York hospital where she is remembering her stormy relationship with O'Neill. Colleen Dewhurst, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
You've played in a lot of O'Neill's plays, and
yes.
Now you're playing the role of his widow. Is playing a woman in his life at all similar to playing a woman that he wrote about?
I never thought of it that way. I guess, yes, it is, because I think that the wonderful thing about O'Neill women is the fact that O'Neill always insists that you go all the way. He won't... I've always said that if you try to get safe with O'Neill, it becomes melodrama and becomes embarrassing. So you have to take the chance. That's where Jose Quintero was so wonderful. You have to take the chance and go down to the bottom of the pit. And
what kind of chance specifically are we talking about here?
I suppose it's what I call a stripping, a removal of the mask. In other words, I feel that we're... And it's funny because O'Neill used masks in some of his early plays. And I think it's the thing that we're all masked pretty well for each occasion. I mean, in other words, we could say that you and I both have on the mask for this occasion, whatever we're bringing to it and have decided is the proper attitude and way that we will behave during this, unless something throws us. And I think we spend a lot of time watching people to see when the mask slips. And you see under there, you know, you're talking to someone who seems perfectly all right and fine, and you'll see that slip and you'll realize that you're looking into eyes or something that are suffering through, and then the mask comes back up. And I think with Carlotta, without realizing it until you said that, that it's true again in Carlotta, the demand is made that the woman strip down sometimes to what is what I call bare knuckle, and then the pulling together again. But of course, she is more vulnerable because the mind is not always in control.
You're acting in a one-person show now. I guess the pleasures of acting alone on stage must be pretty different than those of acting with an ensemble.
I think pleasure is a word that I... pleasure in acting is that wonderful feeling of coming on stage one night and two of you looking at each other and knowing that you've got it, that you're on, that it's moving and that it's right and everything. And of... having that energy coming back to you that can... But in this case, I'd said one time, Barbara got very upset because I'd given an interview before we opened saying that this was the worst experience of my life. And that Zoe had said to me, who had done Lillian Hellman, and she said to me, "Oh, you're going to hate it, darling. It is just awful up there, just awful." I said, after I began rehearsing, I was just going to call her up and scream into the phone and hang up, and she'd know who was calling. But it is, it's just a, because it's a self-generated energy, and you have nowhere to get energy from. You eventually, I believe, are, but it'll take a while, are eventually taking energy from the house. But it's not, people say, "Well, you know, why wouldn't you?" And I said, if you really look at other one-person shows, they usually, 99% of them are people who speak to the house at intervals, who will turn and make a...
an aside.
That's right, to them or look right at them and laugh or do whatever they're going to do. Now, that is relaxing. They have now... But you're playing with the four walls. There is no way that you can... How shall I say? ask them to like you. You can't, you're up there entirely dependent upon your script and your own energy level.
You know, for years you worked primarily in theater, and then you started doing more movie roles. You've been doing more television now as well. You got an Emmy Award this year for your performance in that made-for-TV movie. Was it a conscious decision for you to get more into television and movies? Is that something that you'd been wanting to do?
Well, no. I mean, people used to ask me years ago, why had I chosen not to do film? I'd go, oh, no, no. It sounded so kind of wonderfully altruistic, as if I'd said, no, no, the theater is my work. I said, yeah, I'm on the first plane out of here if someone would ask me to do a film. And then I did films I would do. I did a lot of, when I began in TV, it was in things that were the play of the week on public television with Susskind and Eli Landau. And I literally, that was the day of the live show. And when I finally began to get some live television, I became known as the person who closed every show. They'd announced that no longer would they have a live show in New York, and I'd finally get a job on it. I would do that show, and that was the end of that show. The U.S. Steel Hour, the this, the that. And then I never really got much. Here and there I would get something. And then I think pretty late on I began to do television and television film, and then I began to get some film. But it wasn't steady. And I think the truth was, too, that people think you made the choice because you wish to always pick something that was good. And as my sons say, I never watch anything I do. I can come into the house and walk past them and realize they're watching a show I'm on, and one of them will say, I say, oh, how's that going? I go, this one was for the money, right, Mom? I'm in this one.
You don't watch any movies that you're in?
No.
Why not?
I don't know. Years ago I watched Play of the Week, and then I'd get very upset. And someone had said to me, you shouldn't really watch anything you do, Colleen, because you're obviously too subjective, not objective enough. And I think probably also in analyzing it, there's a feminine thing that's in there that you're looking at yourself. Sometimes I'd go, what is she doing? Come on, come on. What is happening here? And but I'd also, another part of me would be looking at how I looked. I'd be going, oh, I don't know, I don't look so good there. I don't look.
And you can't afford to be self-conscious when you're acting.
No, and I didn't want to fall into a trap of, I mean, you want to look good. Of course you want to look good. But I didn't want to fall into a trap of that being a concern of mine when I was in front of a camera. I don't want to be concerned about any of the technical thing that is going on around me. I think that, I know actors who are great actors who know just what the camera is doing and just what is happening, and it doesn't affect them at all. I think you have to analyze why, for you, that is not good. I mean, I'm playing for the crew. I mean, as if they were out there watching it, right? Instead of, you learn all the professional things, how to hit your marks and what to do.
You know, one of your movie roles that I really loved was in Annie Hall, where you played Diane Keaton's mother.
Yeah.
And in the movie, for our listeners who have seen it, you are cast as the kind of prototypical goyim. You know,
absolutely.
Because there's a great scene where everyone's around the table eating, and Woody Allen, looking at you, is imagining himself as an Orthodox Jew with payas and a yarmulke on, because you're so non-Jewish to him. How did he cast you for that role? Is that did he really think of you as the prototypical
non-Jew? I don't know.
The
funny thing is that Woody, I went up very high in the estimation of my children when I did that film. But I was doing Moon for the Misbegotten, and Woody had come there, and he would just kind of wander up and stare in the dressing room door and then leave. And then about the second time he came up, Ned Flanders was dressing next to me, and he came up and kind of looked in the door and said who he was. And I went, yes, I know. And he just kind of nodded. And I thought, and Ed said to me, wasn't that Woody Allen? I said, yes. I said, he was here a couple of weeks ago. So about a year passed, I think, and I was doing Virginia Woolf. And suddenly he came backstage and said, did I, you know, what did I think about doing a movie or something? But it was kind of a mumble, and I went, well, I, wow. So then I was sent kind of pieces of paper with dialogue on them.
Well, scraps of paper?
Yes, I mean, it's just kind of a, you know, an idea for a character. And you weren't allowed to see the script, and you didn't know anybody else that was playing in it.
Why?
That was the way he wanted it. I mean, I didn't know who was playing my husband or who was playing anything the day I was taken out in the car to New Jersey and entered a house. And
God, you describe it as if you're being kidnapped.
And, I know, and was introduced around and kind of, and I thought, and I myself thought it was odd that he picked me as kind of, I mean, what I saw, because I hadn't read any script and I never saw the movie, was that kind of the perfect Englewood, New Jersey, white wasp woman and her children and everybody. I thought, it's very strange, but it's interesting what someone's view, especially if you consider that what he was seeing in me, that he had been to A Moon for the Misbegotten like three times. He'd seen this Irish farm woman. But, and I think what he did, I mean, there were a lot. There was Jerry, Maureen after that. You know, it was like there were several of us of that group that he just reached in and would pick out at several, you know, certain times and put you in.
I want to ask you about another movie, and this is much earlier in your career, and I'm thinking of The Nun Story. And you were on camera it's a very small role, but that role has haunted me. I remember seeing that when I was a child, and I'm thinking of the scene, Audrey Hepburn plays the nun,
right.
And she's working at a mental institution. And she walks in to take care of someone who's supposed to be violent, but she's very subdued now. Mm-hmm. You're that patient. And you just kind of, as I remember it, just like rise up and try to kill mm-hmm. her. You tear the habit off of her head. And it's a terrifying, terrifying scene. As a matter of fact, I looked
that
it up.
That was the first film I ever
was
did.
Was it the first film?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I looked it up in Leonard Maltin's Guide to TV Movies today, and it's a little two-line thing, and he mentions you in one of those two lines. You know, he says, Colleen Dewhurst as a homicidal patient is electrifying. And there's no room for him to say this in that little capsule, believe me. But I want to ask you about how you did that role, because it was so... electrifying is a good word, and such as your first role, a small role?
I don't know. I just, that was a very exciting year for me. And I'd gone in to see Fred Zinnemann, who I didn't know who he was, and then she had, and he didn't say what role. Again, someone who sits and looks at you, right? Just stares at you. And then my agent called and said, well, you have the part? I said, what part is it? And she said, it's the Archangel. I was waiting to play the nuns. I mean, everybody was playing a nun. I thought, every actress wants to play a nun or a whore, right? And those are always parts you want to play. And I said, the Archangel Gabriel, what is that? And I'm getting the book, trying to read it and find out. And I loved when I went over there, because it was my first time in Europe. And to go to Rome, I mean, mm-hmm. I was hysterical. And I landed at this hotel with several wonderful actresses all talking, and I never forgot. One of them said, an American, they were American and British. She said, I don't know what it, they say that Zinnemann is able to judge you by your face, what he sees in your face. And she said, and I'm the only mean nun. She said, so I don't know what that means. So there was kind of a pause, and I went, well, I know, but you're all playing nuns, and I'm playing someone who is schizophrenic and crazy out of her mind, right? But when I went in, they asked me, they had arranged for me to go to an insane asylum. And I said, no, I didn't wish to do that.
To do research.
And I said, well, you just have to trust me. I said, I really don't want to. So I remember they came in and they had a specialist there, of course, and everything, an Italian who was wonderful. So the first was, I can remember still, was catatonic. And I remembered entering the cell, which wasn't. And he said, Fred said to me, is there anything that... I said, no, just actually lock the door. And he went, okay, we'll lock the door. So we locked the door, and that was the way they started the first one. The other thing I remember him saying was, coming up and saying, now listen, Colleen, Audrey is a very frail woman. I went, okay. I realized, I thought, in those days, I was considered a really tall,
right,
big girl. Back in those days, there weren't women who were 5'8" acting in film. I suppose I looked like I could kill her. But I loved doing it.
It was a great performance. I want to talk to you more about your work on stage and screen, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Colleen Dewhurst, and she's currently performing in Philadelphia in a one-person show called My Jean, and she plays the role of Eugene O'Neill's widow. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Actress Colleen Dewhurst is my guest. You just said that when you were working in The Nun Story that you were considered very big then. You're very tall. You're not considered tall now? Have standards changed for women actors? For women actresses, redundant. But have standards changed for women?
I think when I was in my 20s, I think everywhere I went, they'd speak of how tall I was. In fact, I really got started in playing women who were, I mean, I was always playing the woman who was leading the army in Shakespeare or ate her children in a pie or broke up the family or something. And I just, I realized suddenly that I was, I think one of my first big breaks was in Ballad of the Sad Cafe that Edward Albee attained, which was this big woman. And then, of course, the big break was Moon for the Misbegotten, which was another oversized woman. And then I've noticed that maybe in the last 10 years, suddenly there are very tall women out there that 5'8" is not considered terribly tall or terribly big. But for a while there, I would not, when I began to break through, I would not be hired because the leading man was not tall.
We know what I'm thinking, too. You have very strong facial features, and it looks, you look like a strong woman. You look physically strong and emotionally strong, and it would be hard for you to play the kind of frail, vulnerable leading lady. You know, and there have been periods where leading ladies have been that way.
Well, I think probably it was that I was never an ingenue. I could never, in other words, entering New York, I think, when I was 20. And everybody in that age span that was coming in, that was, were ingenues. And I remember saying to Joe Papp one time, he hadn't seen me, and it was when he was first starting, and he just called me on the phone and said that his wife had seen me in a class and thought I would, that he was going to do Romeo and Juliet. He had taken a small church down on 6th Avenue and 6th Street. And I went, you've never seen me, have you? And I said, no. I said, well, I couldn't do Juliet when I was 12. I knew by that. I knew nothing about my voice or anything. Only when I hit into New York did people begin to pick out characteristics about you in a class, they would mention something, right?
Well, I think your voice is one of the most striking things about your performances. You have such a wonderful voice, and its huskiness has so much a kind of character in it and a certain even mystery to it. Have you worked to develop your voice at all?
No, I would always, every once in a while, I'll see someone commenting on the voice, and I'll hear something about whiskey. They'll have a whiskey will come in there, whiskey something tone voice, or cigarette. And finally, one time I said to somebody, you know, I said, I have to tell you that when I was in sixth grade, because I can remember it vividly, I said, each class, I said, had to do a country, and our country was Russia. And I was very excited because all our little group was doing were the boys and the girls together were singing a Russian song, which went, Eugnem, Eugnem. And the day came, and my mom and dad were coming that night and everything, and I had my little Russian dress. And so in came the music teacher. And she said, and the girls sang first, and then she said, she did the girls, and then she went, there's something wrong on the girls' side. And she said, girls, will you go again? And so all the girls were going, Eugnem. And in the middle was me going, Eugnem. And she went, what is your name? And I said, my name's Colleen. She said, Colleen, tonight, just mouth it.
So you had a deep voice even
yes,
then.
Yes, I obviously, but I never was conscious of. My sons used to laugh because when I would call home, collect. And one of them would pick up the phone and they'd say, we have a collect call for anyone from a Mr. Dewhurst. And there'd be a pause and I'd go, yes, I'll accept it. Hi, Mom. There is no Mr. Dewhurst.
You know, I think we usually think of actors as being bodies. We usually think of them physically. But with someone like you, you really think of the voice, too, because your voice is that striking. I think, you know, for a lot of actors, the first thing you think of is their face or how they look. And with you, like, the voice is there, right? Right there with how you look.
It's very strange. It really is, because as time goes on, you will hear more and more people. Things happen through the years, and you don't realize they're happening because you're not paying any attention to the fact that time is going and that now definition is coming.
You know, I should mention, people said, oh, it's a whiskey voice. No, it's a cigarette voice. You do smoke cigarettes.
Yes.
Have you tried to stop or anything because of your career on stage or life in general?
No, I think I've three or four times I've tried to stop for reasons which probably more involve sons.
Uh-huh.
You know, that they get tense, and I can understand that, yes, it would be your fault if you were to go before time, so to speak.
You have two sons?
Yes, two boys.
And it's very hard, and it was especially more difficult when you were a young mother than it probably is now. It's been very hard to have a career and raise a family at the same time. And you once said that you felt in a way you owed your career to your housekeeper, who mm-hmm. helped you keep things together, helped
Nana, yes.
helped you with your moves, helped you with your children. And I thought that was a really interesting thing to say.
She was wonderful. She was really terrific. And I was lucky because I didn't have the children when I was young. And I don't know what I would have done when I look at, you know, actresses or women who are even now my son's wife, who is a very, very bright gal who has had two children very quickly. And I know that mentally she is ready to go out, you know, to begin either a law career or something. And yet I understand their reasoning, which is to have it done early, have the children, and then to be able to have the life. But I was lucky because my then husband, who I had married, he had a career that was moving, so that there was not worry on.
Was this George Scott?
Yes, not worry on the financial area. And Nana came with me before I had Alex. I was pregnant, but I realized it was wonderful because I was working in theater. Some people will say, well, that I gave up. Every once in a while I'll see an article saying that because of being married and having children that I missed a big part of my career, and that's why I was. That's not true, because I was still working. I was working for, like, Joe
Papp.
And working for Jose and Ted down at the Circle. But the wonderful thing was that the boys were only 11 months apart, much to my shock and surprise. So it was like having twins. But you could put them to bed at night. And then you went to the theater, and then at 6:30 and 7 in the morning, you were still there. So they had no... So all during the growing up period, I really was more home than away. It really was only in the last 10 years that I've really been flying out to places and staying. I'd never stay more than 2 weeks away from them, and if it was going to be more, then I carried them. I took them with me.
You made a little joke before about taking roles that you're offered. Do you take what you're offered, or do you turn down roles that you don't?
In the theater, I turn down.
Uh-huh.
But quite honestly, in film and television, there was a period there where, well, there were a couple of periods where I took roles that paid very well,
mm-hmm.
but that I wasn't, I think, I always say the dangerous thing is to take something and then try to make believe. I mean, when you get on that plane for California, you cannot sit there and say to someone, I've had it said to me, well, of course, you know, this isn't really, the script isn't terribly good, but... I feel there is something in the part that I want to go, oh, come on. We're flying out there for the money. They're hoping they're paying you for fast. They figure you'll study, that you'll go to bed at night, and that you'll be there on time, and that you're not going to make a fuss or worry about your hair or anything, that you'll be on the set. You'll know your lines, and you may try to make it look like more than a cardboard cutout of a woman. But there's been a couple of years now that I've played... for TV, that I've really, really loved the experience.
And you want to do more of it?
Oh, yes. Which I, you know, it's an entirely different discipline. But it's, I like it now. I mean, there are certain roles that I'm really proud of now. And it's always interesting because when people speak to you, because many people across the country only know you from film, they will always mention the same women.
Which ones?
Well, there was a movie I did called And Baby Makes Six, mm-hmm. and they insist on that one. The Woman's Room, Anne of Green Gables, Between Two Women, always the same. And always, interestingly enough, women who are of a certain age who are viable.
Well, I love your acting, and it's been wonderful to have you here. I thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
My guest has been actress Colleen Dewhurst, and in Philadelphia, she's currently starring in the Joe Papp production My Jean, a one-woman show about Eugene O'Neill's widow. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.